winning 15 in a row in 2017. The Knicks will have a chance to tie that record if they can sweep the next two games in Madison Square Garden. For NPR News, I'm Bruce Kahnweiser.
In women's tennis, Russian teenager Mira Andreeva won the French Open today. I'm Noor Rahm, NPR News, in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, supporting creative people and effective institutions committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information is at macfound.org.
It is that time once again, my friends. Welcome to The Conversation on WVIK, a weekly celebration of local radio the way it's meant to be brewed. This week, my guest is Kate Bodenbender from the Genesius Guild. I'm Kai Swanson. I hope you'll stick around for this week's Conversation on WVIK. Well, Kate Bodenbender, I can't tell you how long I've been looking forward to this ever since we had a chance to figure out a schedule that worked for us, because I have been admiring your work from afar, and now I get a chance to just chat with you. Kate, thank you for coming in.
Well, thank you for having me.
And we're going to get to all that stuff in just a minute. But first, I thought I always like to start at the very beginning, right? It's like a prologue from Henry V. You got to have a little bit of the background and the context and all that kind of stuff. Did you grow up around the Quad Cities, or are you a transplant?
I grew up around the Quad Cities. Well, from about fifth grade on.
Oh, okay.
I was in the Quad Cities in Rock Island. Very close here to Augustana, actually.
Well, where were you before fifth grade?
Bloomington, Illinois.
Oh, fantastic.
And prior to that, the East Coast, but I don't remember it much.
I know. I've got those earlier memories. I was two when we came here. So if you were in the neighborhood of Augustana, did you go to Longfellow?
I did.
You did, as did I.
Oh, wonderful.
There we go. Hey, dear old alma mater.
Mm-hmm.
actually, though, I have to say I'm a little bit older than you, but in the 70s, it was a great neighborhood to grow up in. I mean, it was just... Rock Island was incredibly wealthy, and your folks either worked for Augustana, John Deere, or IH, and it was a pretty cool place to grow up. And we had Lincoln Park.
Yes, we did.
Absolutely.
We absolutely did. It was much the same when I was there in the 80s. What was that? 85, that would have been.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Well, it's just a great place. And the little secret that I don't want to let too many people in the Quad Cities know is, as hot as it can get here in the summer and the humidity is driving you crazy, if you are on the brink of the valley, if you're at the hilltop in either Longview or Lincoln Park in Rock Island, I assume Stevens Park in Moline, similar, but it is always 10 degrees cooler.
Yes.
And there's a breeze, because the pressure changes at the top of the hill, and it's lovely. So
yes.
Well, maybe we shouldn't tell too many people that.
My parents live about a block and a half away, and it is. I get out of my car, and it is cooler than it was in front of my house.
There you go.
Always, yeah.
I love great. That. So then you went on, I assume, then to Rock Island High School?
I did,
And
yeah.
Rock Island has always had a pretty strong reputation for, I think, language arts.
Yes.
And all manner of college prep. What were the things that struck your fancy when you were a high school kid?
English, Shakespeare, in fact. I feel like I got an incredible education in writing and reading at Rock Island High School.
In fact, I did a little research, Kate, and you and I have a common hero, or someone that we both deeply revere, in Art Milton.
Yes.
You had Mr. Milton, too?
Yes, I did. I did. He was definitely, reading Hamlet with him was an important thing, an important change in my life. Yeah. It wasn't the first Shakespeare I had ever read, and I did love Romeo and Juliet when I read it as a freshman, as we all did at the time. Still now, even. But reading Hamlet with Mr. Milton was different.
Tell me why. Because I had Romeo and Juliet in ninth grade in mm-hmm. Rock Island schools. In fact, I have a friend who teaches at Davenport Central. He teaches ninth grade. They still do Romeo and Juliet. But what was different about having a different teacher?
The way that Mr. Milton, I suppose I'm an adult, he's told me I could call him Art long ago, but Mr. Milton was a very engaging instructor, just in general. And when it came to Shakespeare, to Hamlet, he knew the text so well, and he cared so much about it, and he got us reading it. And actually putting our voices to it and hearing my classmates read it and getting to read it myself really changed the experience completely from just kind of just reading it, which is what I had done as a freshman. So it changed how I thought about it. It felt more like a play instead of a book, which made me relate to it in a different way.
My experience was a little bit different. They had juggled things. There were some other teachers there at the high school when I was there. And so I didn't get Mr. Milton until 12th grade. Mm-hmm. But I think the turning point for me was in ninth grade. In addition to seeing Romeo and Juliet, I forget for which class. I think it was Mr. Young's class. I cannot exactly remember, but we all had to memorize a soliloquy.
Yes. No, that was definitely Mr. Milton. We had to do the same thing.
Well, but this was before I had met him, and it could be. And for me, the turning point was having to memorize Friends, Romans, Countrymen. Mm. I mean, pretty cliche mm-hmm. there, right? Mm-hmm. But really diving into it and parsing words and looking where the phrases came from and all that kind of stuff. It does give you a much deeper, it's not just a play or a book. It is you feel like you're trying to decode something of what it means to be a human.
Yes, absolutely.
Right. So I had a very similar experience, and I'm grateful that you had one too, courtesy of the Rock Island Milan mm-hmm. School District. When it was time to move on from there, what was next for you?
Well, first I went off to Minneapolis, Minnesota, and I was a singer there. I started my undergraduate in music. That's not where I finished it, but I left to sing with the Minnesota Opera Company in their chorus for a number of years. And then after that, I suppose I was there for around 8 years, and I came home because I didn't know exactly what I wanted to do next. And one of the things I wound up doing was actually finally performing up with Genesis Guild, which is something that I had wanted to do pretty much my whole life, and I always felt a little bit too shy to actually audition for. And I was cast, and I was hooked. I was hooked. And from there, it's history, I suppose.
Well, we're going to get into that in a minute, but I want to go back to Minnesota. Do you have some recollections of favorite choruses or other performances that you did while you were in Minnesota?
Yes. I would say that there was so much good music made. The Minnesota Opera Company had, at the time and still, just an incredible chorus. Great solo artists, but the chorus is extraordinary. That good Lutheran choir tradition in action. Yeah. So I have a lot of very positive memories. I have two that stand out. One was when we were singing Otello, and there's a chorus called the Fuoco di... I called it the Dance of the Fireballs. I don't remember exactly what it's called in Italian, but it was it was just really musically rich, and we sang it. Everyone sang it so well, and I was part of something bigger. And I felt like me and my voice were at a different level than they were the rest of the time because of working with those people and making that music. What I remember about that particular chorus is that when it was originally played, it was one of those situations where the audience applauded so much the first time that opera premiered that they sang it again. So it's a great piece, and I have a lot of positive memories about that. The other one was singing a piece by Kurt Weill, so very, very different, which was incredibly difficult because the harmonics were really hard. I was one of the inner voices. I'm a mezzo. And I just remember working so hard on that. And when we finally got to performance, all of us in the chorus just felt like we had really achieved something because it was really quite intricate. Wow. So those are my two favorite memories.
Well, mine are very, very slim, but when Genesius Guild used to do operas,
yes.
Wooten knew better. I mean, I don't know how to read music, but being a Lutheran, I just would hear it, and then, you know, mm-hmm. by about the fourth verse, I'd have most of it, right? So he always put me in the chorus, and I would tuck myself in between a couple of Augustana choir members, mm-hmm. right? Because I knew if I can just mimic them, at least it won't be too discordant. Yeah. So, I mean, I remember those choruses, but in all the realm of opera. When people wonder, you know, what is the role? I mean, the arias catch all the attention. What is the role of the choruses? I come back to the same story. When Verdi died, and they had initially interred him in Milan, but they were going to move him to be buried in Casa di Riposo, the place that he built for aging musicians outside. And as they transferred his casket along the cobblestone road up to Castello di Riposo, something like 1,000 people sang the chorus of the Hebrew Slaves.
Yeah,
yes. As they went on up. And it was just to imagine the scene is phenomenal. Anyway, that's why we do radio, because they say the pictures are better. All right, so when do you get back to the Quad Cities?
In 2001.
Okay.
I came back in 2001.
How was that first audition? Because many people, their first time on stage in a play is at Genesius Guild, because mm-hmm. it intentionally wants people doing the shows who have never done shows before. But walk us through that process.
Well, I was nervous because the performers up at Genesius Guild were a little bit heroes to me, having grown up a block and a half away. So I was definitely nervous about it. And I did keep telling myself, you get up in front of people and sing all on your own. You can do this. You can definitely read this. You've got a script in front of you. There are other people on stage with you. You'll be fine. I was still scared. But everybody made it really easy to do. And back at that time, there you would kind of read multiple parts with different people, different pairings. And so it became play very quickly. It was fun to audition. So once I got past my initial fear, I had a really good time.
Do you remember your first show?
Yes. My first show was Trojan Women. I played Hecuba.
And who was directing?
Sally Ann
McCarthy.
McCarthy, yes.
Oh, what a legend.
Yes.
What a great legend. Oh, yes. She was amazing. And one of the kindest.
Yes.
And it's always struck me that I got a chance to hang out with a couple of directors, just, you know, community theater like Genesius Guild. And the ones who were the calmest and gentlest got the most out of us.
Yes.
And she was a calm and gentle soul.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I'm grateful that you said that. I still have my first script. It was from a production of Coriolanus. I was nervous as heck doing the auditions. And I was like citizen number 3. So I had like basically one line. But I took the whole, in those days, they would hand out the Folger's Library edition because they were the cheapest ways you could get a bunch of Shakespeare books, right? Mm-hmm. And I think my line was, kill him, and it's highlighted. That was just so, but I was like you. I grew up in the shadow of Lincoln Park. I was kind of down at the bottom of 44th Street. Mm-hmm. And going over there on a summer's night, and in true Guild fashion, sometimes I wouldn't say roaming, you're doing the ne'er-do-well things of a 15-year-old, 14-year-old mm-hmm. kid. And you say, wait, what are they doing over there? And that's how I got my foot caught in the door. But yeah, that one line. And then we did a few other things over the years. But what are some of the other shows that you really remember fondly?
I was part of Bump Eater's Henry IV's. There came the following summer, I believe. Mm. That was an amazing experience in a lot of ways. And I had not ever gotten to perform Shakespeare before, and to be able to kind of have Shakespeare's words in my mouth was an amazing, amazing thing.
What were your
thing.
Roles in those?
I was in Henry IV Part II. Mm-hmm. I was Hotspur's wife.
Oh.
I got to yell at Bob Hansky about having left my husband to die. It was great.
Well, as way leads unto way, I got to be Hal in 1 and 2 back in the 90s, early 90s, somewhere in there.
Almost certainly saw you do that. You were great, actually.
No, stop.
No, that like I'm having a moment. No, yes.
These headphones won't fit if you make my head. So anyway, but Hansky, Bob Hansky, the legendary educator from United Township High School, who was also one of the most generous actors I've ever worked with. I'm trying to remember what he did in each. I think he was my dad in Part One, and then due to a scheduling difference, then I think Pat Flaherty was the king in Part Two, I think, if I remember right. I just remember the Ehrenberg kid. He was so good. I'd love to connect with him again, but he was Percy. And yes. Yeah, just that line standing over him, food for worms, brave Percy. That's, yeah. Oh, yeah. Man, those were great memories. And then they continued, and I got to do Henry V the next summer, which was, yeah, I should have just retired at that point from everything, because I don't know that I'll ever do anything that fun, important, big, whatever. But it's a place for great memories. So, folks, if you're listening to this conversation with Kate Bodenbender, who was going to be the director of one of the major shows this summer, I hope you're getting the point that you've ever had an inkling that maybe I should be on a stage. Well, the Genesius Guild wants to enable that.
Absolutely.
We want to be your enabler in all that. When did the directing become part of your repertoire?
That was in 2003. And basically, a group of friends who were up at the park with me every summer doing Genesius Guild. We're talking about how the kind of theater that had to happen there outside, people who don't know theater probably don't know how much the venue determines how something is performed. And what Genesius Guild does is really, I mean, it's they've honed it to perfection how they do. They perform outdoors. And we wanted to try something different. So we decided that we would do a show. We were going to do one show. It was going to be off the guild season. And a friend said, if you can find a place, I'll cut the script and direct. And I was like, fantastic. So we did that, Measure for Measure. We started with no money. I believe I used some of my student loans to help produce it. Wise decisions that we make in our mid-20s. Mm-hmm. And it was we had so much fun. We had a good response, and we thought, oh, we'll do another one. And the person who had directed J.C. Luxton was like, I don't want to direct another one. And I said, I'll direct one. And they said, what do you want to direct? And I said, well, the play I know best is Hamlet. So the next year in the fall, we did Hamlet. We opened on Halloween because it's a ghost story, obviously. Mm-hmm. And that was the beginning. Starting directing with something like Hamlet is a blessing and a curse. On the one hand, you have a lot of things to live up to. On the other hand, it's really hard to mess it up. It's written so well, you would almost have to be trying. So that was where it started.
Well, reading group at the college just ended this school year with Hamnet. And I don't know if you had a chance to read that.
I have not had a chance to read it. I have it to read. It's on the to-be-read shelf.
There's a bit of a stretch trying to make that closing scene where Shakespeare's wife goes to the Globe and sees Hamlet performed. Mm-hmm. But still an interesting read for anybody who's interested in Shakespeare. So a little bit of a detour here, Kate. Why are we so interested in Shakespeare still to this day?
I could talk for a long time about that.
Radio. Take your time.
I'll try to be brief.
No!
talking less is not my forte, so don't worry about it. I can try, but we'll see. So there are a couple of reasons. One is because, of course, the language is amazing. And once you start to crack it open, it's more and more interesting as you go. It's beautiful. It's heartbreaking. Sometimes it's not as great. Like sometimes he was like, I have to get this show up. And it's, you know, he could be a little bit of a hack on occasion. But that's also delightful because when you know the plays well enough, you're like, oh, look, this just got cranked out to get it on stage, didn't it? And I noticed that. And of course, then maybe it was also one of his collaborators. Maybe it was Fletcher or whatever. So there's that. The language is, you know, I mean, he's the greatest playwright in the English language. That's just, I feel like that's not an opinion. I feel like that's just a fact. So there's that. The other thing that I think really keeps Shakespeare fresh and alive, you know, for 400 years is that what's not there. What's not there are stage directions that say angrily or cross upstage left or with disappointment on her face. None of those sorts of markings are in the script. All you have are the words that the characters say, which means that there's an enormous amount of room to do essentially close reading, kind of literary analysis, but also character work, because there are many ways that a person might say those things. And you have to read all the things the characters say and the things the other characters say, and come to a decision, how am I going to present this character? And as a result, we see ourselves reflected in it when we perform it and when we watch it. the way people perform it has changed over time because people have changed over time. And yet, people have also stayed the same. So we constantly are, no matter what age it is, I think we will always see ourselves and our society and our lives reflected in Shakespeare's works because there is this wide space underneath the text for us to play in. There are things that are not allowed by the text. There are things like that doesn't mean that you can't do that, right? Mm-hmm. There are things mm-hmm. that are not allowed, and that mm-hmm. is definitely true. But there is almost always more than one way to do it. Mm-hmm. And it makes it just an incredible acting challenge. And as a director, it's just really fun to help actors find what they're going to do, to act as an editor for them until you get a piece that's all of these people in the same world that they've come up with together, using these words that someone wrote 400 years ago. And somehow it still feels like it could be happening right now. It's an incredible thing. That's what I think.
Well, we're going to find out even more what you think as we keep going on here. So don't worry. You're not going to get let off that easy. But I have to, so we can come back to this later. We're going to take a break in a couple of minutes. But, you know, a lot of times people like to take the Shakespeare and move it into a different epoch. And mm-hmm. I don't mind that. So I'm not one of these, I don't think there's a dogmatic way of doing things. But for me, I would almost rather you just do it in whatever clothes you're comfy with. Because to your point, it's about the verbiage. Mm-hmm. And then if I'm thinking, well, could this really work on the streets of Chicago in 1927? Or is this really Mussolini and his rise? You know, and then I'm getting distracted.
Yes.
And so either make an attempt, like they did. They didn't know how mm-hmm. Henry V dressed at Agincourt, but they just had colorful outfits and mm-hmm. whatnot. Either go street clothes or... You know, try to do something that looks authentic. I don't know. What do you have a take on that?
I have on occasion seen Shakespeare set in a very specific moment in history, and I think once I've seen it work, I think it is interesting. And I won't say that when I'm directing, I don't think about who would this character be nowadays. Right. Who would be the king if we don't have kings? Who would it be that would this character was? But that's different than setting it in a very specific time. I think it can be done beautifully, but it's incredibly hard to pull off. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's not my favorite, I'll admit.
No, but when it works, I mean, it's really cool.
Yes, it is.
I totally get that.
Yes. Right? It is difficult to do because of exactly what you said. We can't help but be watching and going, well, that's not... Yeah. Quite right. And people who might know the period are like, well, those aren't the right kind of bottles. You know, right. I mean, exactly. It's very hard to nail it. It's distracting.
And he didn't know what they were wearing on the streets of Verona at exactly. No. Well, anyway, we're getting a little bit of far afield here. But here's the great part. Kate Bodenbender is my guest. And we haven't even begun to scratch the surface because the Genesius Guild season starts this very evening. Now, you're going to find all of the details if you go to genesius.org. Now, that's a lot like Genesis. Just add a U after the I, genesius.org. The season opens this weekend with Love's Labor's Lost and next weekend, too, before at the end of June, latter half, Sophocles' Antigone. Then in July, we're going to be talking much with Kate about The Taming of the Shrew, which will be performed July 11, 12, 18, and 19. But right now, we are coming up on 29 minutes past the hour. You're listening to The Conversation on WVIK with this week's guest, Kate Bodenbender from the Genesius Guild. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Support for Quad Cities NPR, WVIK, comes from Aunt Rhody's Landscaping and Design Studio in Eldridge. Designing and installing landscapes to include patios, fire pits, ponds, outdoor lighting, and more. A full scope of services and scheduling consults is available at AuntRhody's.com. And support for WVIK also comes from the Levitt Amp Galva Music Series, offering family-friendly concerts in Wiley Park, Galva, Illinois, on Sundays at 6 p.m. Open to the public. A full list of performers is available at levittamp.org/galva. And support for WVIK comes from family-owned Rafferty Funeral Home in Moline, providing grief words, a resource for those experiencing the loss of a loved one. More information by following the Grief Words link at RaffertyFunerals.com or at 309-797-1900.
Welcome back to The Conversation on WVIK this week, featuring a chat with Kate Bodenbender, who is with the Genesius Guild. And you're doing something very special. Before the break, we mentioned a little bit about the season. Yeah. Go to genesius.org, get the whole details. I really want to talk about Taming of the Shrew.
Fantastic. So do I.
Well, and it's been like so many of his really good scripts in terms of the language. It not only has been done a lot, it has been talked about a lot. And there are voices that say, you know, we've gone past the time where we have this misogyny about roles of subservient roles of women and all this kind of stuff. And yet, based on what I've heard, you're going to really take those issues and put them in front of us and help us really think about them. So talk to me about your vision for Taming. Well, actually, let's just do a preview of the script. For people who aren't familiar with Taming of the Shrew, walk us through it.
Okay. Let's where will I start? So we have two sisters. One is very kind and supposedly docile, very obedient to her father, and the other is not. She's very unpleasant. They refer to her as cursed, which at the time basically would mean rude, right? She was quite rude. She's violent. And so there are these two daughters. Both of them need spouses as the women at the beginning of any Shakespearean comedy do. People want to marry the younger sister, who is Bianca, the kind, beautiful one. No one wants to marry Catherine, the older, unkind one, and their father puts out a stipulation. No one can marry Bianca until Catherine is married first. This is a problem. Bianca has suitors. They want their time in the sun. They want a chance to court her. Luckily, a young man happens into town who is not really interested in having a docile wife. What he's interested is in having a rich wife. And both of these girls are that. Petruchio comes to town with his servant Grumio, who might be my favorite character in the play. Very funny. They come to town. He decides he's going. He hears about this from his friend who wants to marry Bianca. He says, I'll take her. The mean one, the crabby one, the one who's going to maybe hit me. That sounds good. I'll take her. Is she rich? Good. And that's what he does. To her, with her protesting to a certain degree, although she never exactly stops it, she says she doesn't want to, and yet she's mad when he doesn't show up to the altar to marry her. So they do get married, and it's one of those relationships that, like, you look at that couple and you go, do they even like each other? There's just a lot of tension. They're very quick-witted. It's a little bit like a proto Beatrice Benedict, except they're not as likable.
So I got to play Benedict, by the way.
Yeah. I was Beatrice once. A very fun role to play.
Lovely.
Yeah. So, but Petruchio marries her, and they head off to their home. Bianca has two suitors. Three suitors. One is an older man. He's usually played as a very old man, and he's quite funny as well. Then there are two younger suitors. One is a guy from out of town, and one is not, I suppose. Both of them pretend to be dress up, disguise themselves as instructors, because while Bianca's father does not want her to marry, he does want her to be educated. So he hires them to teach her one music and the other books. So, and they proceed to woo her secretly. One of them wins. The one from out of town wins. And eventually the other is dissuaded from pursuing the match any further. Where am I in this story? There's always so much going on.
I know. It's so lovely. And you're doing a great job.
Okay. So Petruchio and Kate are married.
Yeah.
Bianca and Lucentio, that's the guy from out of town who's pretending to be Cambio, then the English teacher, essentially. They are enamored and want to be married, but right now that's not happening. Tranio, who is Lucentio's manservant, who is pretending to be Lucentio. And that's not the hardest to understand situation in the play by any means in terms of disguises. He pretends to want to marry Bianca and gets her father's permission now that Kate has been married. So Bianca is engaged to Lucentio, who is actually Tranio, but in love with Lucentio, who is pretending to be Cambio.
Simple.
Yep, no problem. No problem. But it works out in the end. It works out
in the
end.
They always do.
Somehow the business with Tranio acts as a distraction. Lucentio and Bianca run off and elope. He sort of has her father's blessing, and yet not at all. But supposedly there, he's, where am I? So Bianca's going to get married to her father thinks is Lucentio. And so Kate and Petruchio come back from their home for the wedding. When they get there, it turns out that Lucentio is Tranio and Cambio is Lucentio, and they're married. Anyway, it's a happy ending.
Clear as the Mississippi in July.
That's as good as I can do for
I love
the,
it. No, and I love the way you gave the descriptions. But so there is an awful lot that's going on, as there always is. And it doesn't seem to make sense, but, you know, it all comes together, even without Titania and Oberon sprinkling a little dust everywhere. And I'm sure this will, too. I'm just curious about there is some baggage that goes with it that may not have been there in the 19th century or much of the 20th century, but is something we have to carry with a bit of care now. And tell me how you intend. Well, don't give away too much because we want everyone listening to go and see the show.
Yes.
But what are your thoughts and your vision in bringing this together?
Yeah. So what I related was the humor, and boy, is there a lot of humor in the show. It really is an incredibly funny show, except for what I'm about to discuss.
Go for it.
And at the time, when Shakespeare was writing Taming of the Shrew, the idea of shrew taming was popular in society. Elizabeth had been queen for not very long, and people were not certain how they felt about an unmarried woman in charge of things. And so this kind of trope of taming a shrewish woman happened in theater quite frequently. There are a number of plays that deal with it. One, in fact, called Taming of a Shrew. So in that pursuit, we have Kate, who is a shrew. She is not pleasant. She is sincerely unpleasant. She's not one of those. Everyone says she's unpleasant, but actually everything the character says doesn't indicate that. No. She hits her sister. She ties her up. She's violent with people. She's angry. She's really unpleasant to be around. And in order to change this behavior in her, Petruchio, who does marry her without exactly her consent, although I would say is a little on the fence there, he proceeds to tame her in a manner that we nowadays would not find funny in the slightest. Not at all. He overtly compares the way he is training her to be, to come to his call as though she is a falcon that he is training by starving and watching. And watching was not letting the bird sleep. Mm-hmm. So he, when Kate goes to his home, she is isolated from her family. She is denied food, and she is not allowed to sleep until she will agree to whatever he says, no matter how outlandish it is. Things like, it's nighttime, the moon is out at 12 noon. If she doesn't agree that it is nighttime and the moon is out, she won't eat.
Right.
It's in the modern context, and really at any time, it's terrible. It's awful. And it's supposed to be funny. It's a joke. And that's very difficult for a modern audience. It's the thing to deal with. It sure is.
Well, so when you tie this, though, to the historical birthplace of it with Elizabeth and... A senior history project had me trying to decipher Northumberland's treatise on defense of the regnance of women, because it was a big political conversation at the time. Could you do this? And we know that throughout history and continuing very much so today, there is a disparity. If a person is assertive and shows alacrity in pursuing their point of view, if they're a male, that's laudatory. Mm-hmm. If they're a female, you might use a word other than assertive, right? Mm-hmm. And I've got grandchildren and children of both genders, and I've watched them grow even in a difference of 20 years and how things are changing and getting better and better and better. So in many ways, we have to plop this in a place that's better and better and better. But still, there's that old conversation, and it was on the minds of everybody on the ground floor of the globe when they're thinking about this kind of stuff. And what is the line at which you defer to this queen the same way you would have to her father or any grandsire or anything like that? I can see a lot of even nervous laughter in the globe going on. What are some of the ways you intend to address that? Now, one is by having conversations. And that's why I'm so grateful you're here with us, that you don't go into something like this blind.
Yes.
But what are some of the other ways? Are you going to try to convene other conversations? What thoughts do you have?
Well, we had a little conversation between people about Taming of the Shrew, and then also Taming of a Shrew and Fletcher's The Tamer Tamed, it's the sequel. And Kate has died. Petruchio is remarried, and his new wife Maria actually tames him. This was later in Elizabeth's reign when that was written. So that's kind of fun. maybe we should do that next time.
How about it?
Yeah. I don't think we've ever done any Fletcher at Genesius Guild. So conversations like that. Also, in the way that the show is being presented, the way we're performing it, there are a couple of ways that I am dealing with it. And this is one of those situations where audience and venue is largely impacting the choices that I'm making. I can imagine doing this show and having it be riotously funny, except for the parts that are not, and allowing those to be just as horrific as they are in how we think of them in the modern era, and having an audience left really feeling kind of ashamed for having ever laughed. It can be read really as a tragedy. Kate has a very long speech at the end where she criticizes women who argue with their husbands, and it's a heartbreaking speech to me, actually. Mm. It makes me feel sad every time I read it. Mm-hmm. In the context of the play, with all the humor in it, it's very hard to pull off, no matter how you play it. But that's not what we do up at Genesius Guild. That's a different company. That's for a smaller venue and a narrower audience, right? At Genesius Guild, we've got kids, we've got teenagers, we've got adults, we've got older folks coming in from all over. Anybody can walk up and see it. We've got a big stage, so everything has to be broad and loud. And that is not a great space to have this kind of like introspective commentary happening. But we also can't ignore it because it's there. So what we're doing, first of all, is it's a satire. It would have been a satire. My reading of the play and my understanding of Shakespeare, this play in context with his other plays, do I think Shakespeare really thought taming a woman in this manner was a thing to do? Absolutely not. It's a comedy. It's a joke, right? Yeah. And how do we convey that nowadays? Well, one of the ways that we're doing that is by casting only men in the show, just as Shakespeare would have. Yeah. It's a little bit harder to think about what that woman is experiencing as abuse when that woman is a man and everyone knows that it is being played by a man.
Right.
It restores some of the satire, takes it one step away from that kind of really tight emotional place.
Right.
On the other hand, the women characters were female. They were not camp. They were not really what we would think of as drag nowadays. They were sincerely representing women. And so Kate and Bianca are still real. So that still does happen to a woman. It's a fine line where we're going to be walking as we continue to rehearse it between touching on what is real there and letting the audience feel it and kind of retaining the satire that was originally intended.
Yeah.
It's been something.
Oh, I can't wait. I can't wait. But we do have to wait a few weeks before July 11th when it opens. And we, Kate and I, have to wait just a little bit because right now is the time each week on The Conversation when we step aside and get to hear from Dr. Roald Tweet and Rock Island Lines.
This is Roald Tweet on Rock Island. Rock Island has its share of tail wags dog stories. In one of them, the tail became the dog. As befits a fairy tale, we begin in a sleepy storybook village named Gilbert, just east of Davenport, Iowa. Here, along the Mississippi River, sturdy and thrifty German immigrants raised onions in the rich, flat, bottomland soil. In Gilbert, a resident reported, everybody has a picket fence and a garden, and chickens and a cow and a few pigs. The hard-working farmers likely did not notice two young men surveying the Gilbert waterfront along the railroad tracks in early June of 1902. The men were William P. and Joseph Bettendorf, sons of a German immigrant. They worked together as well as Jack Spratt and his wife. William could invent anything, and Joseph could sell anything William invented. Their wheel factory in Davenport had burned down in May, but it hadn't stopped them. Their new factory in Gilbert opened in late 1902 with 300 employees. Overnight, a local historian put it, the steady people of Gilbert awoke in a whirl of industry, with chimneys that smoke and wheels that hum and shears that chew up boilerplate. The following April, these new residents of unincorporated Gilbert voted to incorporate as the new town of Bettendorf. That same year, William invented a single-piece truck frame for the wheels of railroad cars, a vast improvement over the older mini-piece frames which broke down frequently, and Bettendorf was on its way. The 300 employees grew to 3,000 by 1920. Plant size tripled in 1909 alone with the addition of a foundry and two open-hearth steel furnaces. In the new automated assembly line that extended for almost a mile along the river, raw materials entered one end and a complete railroad car exited the other. But alas, there was a larger dog with a larger tail. The Great Depression wagged the company with the same ease the company had wagged Gilbert. By 1937, the Bettendorf Axle Company was through. There are still a few sleepy towns around Rock Island. Do you have a good idea that needs a place to happen?
Rock Island Lines with Roll Tweet is underwritten by Augustana College, Rock Island, Illinois.
And we get to hear it each and every week on WVIK because folks just like you have made sure that the Quad Cities has a public radio station, a place for ideas like Rock Island Lines to have a home, a place to be celebrated, and a place to have conversations like this one with Kate Bodenbender here on The Conversation on WVIK. If that kind of radio strikes your fancy, I'd love for you to go over to WVIK.org and look for that very subtle button up in the right-hand corner. It's almost flashing. It says donate. And as I'm looking here in the studios, I'm also looking at the Genesius Guild webpage, which has a beautiful donate online button right there. We know what to do with that. But as we talked with Kate Bodenbender about The Taming of the Shrew in July, there's some other great theater coming up first. Love's Labor is Lost begins this weekend, continues June 13, 14. Sophocles' Antigone, the latter two weekends in June. Then after a little bit of a July 4th diversion for The Taming of the Shrew, July 11, 12, 18, 19. And then barreling right towards the Greek comedy, which this year will be Aristophanes' Thesmophoria Zeusae. No, I'm not spelling it. We're also referring to it as the Women's Festival. That'll be the last weekend in July, first weekend in August. All the performances begin at 7. And Kate, how expensive is it to get into a Genesius Guild show?
It is completely free, Kai. You just wander up. You don't even have to bring a chair. There are chairs there already.
And nice little benches, all kinds of things. And I'll never forget my favorite, basically, promo for the Genesius Guild is, ever since it was established in 1956, the audience can be guaranteed they will get their money's worth.
Absolutely.
Usually a lot more, but, you know, it's
I would say more, but yes, certainly at least that. Yeah. At least that.
So directing Taming of the Shrew this summer, I just am fascinated by this because as just a flunky, you know, citizen number two in Coriolanus, I show up, you know, I take my moment in the limelight with the line, kill him, and then I go away. But from a director, you're working on this for a long time.
Yes.
And also on the vision that you want to bring to bear. When did you start working on this summer's production of Taming of the Shrew?
Oh, gosh. I can't even say when it started. I was... Misha Hooker, who was on the artistic committee, asked me if I would be interested in directing something. And I was like, well, what's on the docket? And it wasn't entirely decided, but they had some idea. And I started thinking about a taming at that point. So I have been at least thinking about it since October. At least October. And actively planning since January.
Well, and sometimes we get to have Maestro Mark Russell Smith here, and we talk about things that he hasn't conducted that he would like to. Do you have a wish list, bucket list, whatever you want to call it, of shows that you'd like to see happen under your direction?
There are a couple of shows that I would love to direct. I would love to direct Lear. Mm. I was in Lear as Lear. Which was an experience.
Awesome.
I was far too young for it, but I gave it the best go.
And where was that?
With Prenzi Players.
Prenzi Players, mm-hmm. Fantastic.
Yeah. They had entirely flipped the cast. So I had sons, not daughters, and it was a complete reversal, which is the kind of thing you can do in that company. And it was an incredible experience to attempt to embrace Lear, to be Lear. And I would love to have a go at directing it, to help somebody else through that process. That would be great.
So my one experience with that was, again, I think this is the 90s, maybe late 80s. I'm not even that sure. But Don was given a line on being able to use the John Deere corporate auditorium for a fundraiser for Genesius Guild. And so he directed it. He was Lear. And I got to play Edgar, which means being poor Tom and going nuts. And I won't get into all that specifics, but the fun thing for anyone who loves the Genesius Guild was the first time, because we were rehearsing in an abandoned warehouse on the west side of Rock Island. It was an old factory, actually. And so kind of marking in our heads where this will be and that will be. And then we go into the acoustically perfect space that is the John Deere corporate auditorium at HQ, right? And, you know, in the Genesius Guild, there's one volume and it's screaming because you have to be heard over the cicadas, the trains, the cannons on the arsenal. Back in my day, the occasional Head East concert at Lee's. Yeah,
back
Head East. It was Head East one time. Not a tribute band. It was Head East. They were kind of on the downslope at the time. And but you just have to be really loud. And so I'm grateful that Don really focused and guys like Jeff Cousins on teaching us how to use our diaphragms to be louder than we thought we could be without yelling, right? Well, the first time we show up there and we're just screaming and we had to realize that you could be in the back row of that auditorium and someone on stage whispering could be heard in the back row.
Yes.
And so for us, those of us who just kind of did Guild, it was very much a learning experience.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. That is an important part. When I say venue determines how you perform something, that is a very big part of it.
Yeah.
And it is a specific kind of skill to be able to display emotion at the volume that you have to out at Genesius Guild. Mm-hmm. It's different. It's frankly harder than in a place where everyone can hear you and you can speak more at a regular human volume. We're accustomed to emoting at that volume. People are accustomed to hearing it and knowing what that sounds like and recognizing it. But when you have to get your grief across to an entire park over the sound of a train, that's hard. That's hard. And that's one of the things that we're working on.
Of course, and you have to. And you're right. I'm so grateful to hear you talk about the sensitivity to venue, because if you can't understand the words, it doesn't matter what emotion you're trying to say.
Yes.
My favorite little vignette is Merchant of Venice, who knows how many years ago, and Patty Flaherty was Portia, and I was Bassanio, and there's the scene at the end where, you know, it's all kind of coming together, right? And there's this very tender scene of forgiveness and grace and mercy. And while this is happening, someone who had a few too many over at Lee's rode their bike behind the audience and hit the telephone pole and clonked over. And now in this scene, an ambulance is coming up into the park.
Oh.
But thankfully, he turned the siren off and then rolling with the flashing lights. So as they're going behind the audience, and I'm nearsighted, I'm so blind. So if you're nearsighted, everything is like in soft focus, like a Maureen O'Hara movie, right? And I'm looking at Patty Flaherty. We're trying to, and I think she's just as blind as I am. And all I can see is red, blue, white, red, blue, white, red, blue, white.
Oh my gosh.
While we're
doing
the final scene. It was delicious. It was great.
Those kinds of acting experiences.
Only at the Guild.
Yeah, only at the Guild.
And you can't swat mosquitoes.
Nope.
Yeah.
Nope. It's amazing. It's amazing. I do want to I do want to address the being able to understand what people say.
Yes.
Because I was just actually having this conversation with Anne Balderson last evening.
Uh-huh.
There is a significant degree to which it is, unless you are very intimate with these plays, it is impossible to know exactly what people are saying in some of them.
Right.
Because it's antiquated language in an antiquated sentence structure, and that's being used metaphorically or perhaps idiomatically. To a certain extent, you're not going to be able to understand all the words. You need to be able to understand enough of them.
Yes.
And you need the actors to fill in the rest.
Right.
And if they don't, even I will be lost.
Exactly. Oh, I'm totally with you. A tip, though, is if you haven't ever been to the Genesius Guild, the show starts at 7. Show up a little bit early and get those benches that are the closest to the front, the seats, rather, and you'll be glad for it. My challenge is that being I'm on the board, and so sometimes we help sell concessions just to keep funds going to the Guild, right? So we have to sit kind of farther away. So what do you say? But no, if you have never been to the Guild, sit as close to the front as you can that you're comfortable with, and you're in for a tremendous treat. Can you believe, Kate, we're going to run out of time.
Oh my goodness.
This is unbelievable. And I really want to thank you for your time and being with us. But anything else you'd care to add? I mean, other things that, other theater that we should be aware of, because we're giving a lot of love to Genesius Guild, as we should, but what are some other things we should be aware of around town?
You know, to tell you the truth, I'm so deep in. I'm aware that other theater exists, but I'm not. I couldn't tell you a one of them at this point. I believe that Circus still exists. Yes.
Yes, it does.
We
were just talking about Fiddler on the Roof and what a great, wonderful treasure that is. But Kate, you are also a treasure.
Oh,
I'm grateful
you.
For the time that you spent with us, and look forward to seeing this amazing vision you have come into focus. So Kate Bodenbender, thank you for your time and sharing with us on The Conversation.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, if friends, I want you to remember that if you missed part of this, it's no worries, because you can catch The Conversation twice each week on WVIK. That's the Saturday morning live broadcast at 10 o'clock, right before Wait, Don't Tell Me. And then there's a rebroadcast Monday evenings at 8. That's right after Fresh Air with Terry Gross. And yeah, I don't even believe that I follow Terry Gross in anything. You can also find recent episodes at wvik.org. And the trick there, friends, if you haven't already had a chance to figure that out, is you go to wvik.org and look for us under the podcast tab. Well, from the campus of Augustana College in Rock Island, this is Kai Swanson, thanking once again Kate Bodenbender from the Genesius Guild, and inviting you to join us next week for The Conversation on WVIK. Next week, by the way, our guest will be Holly Sparkman from the QCA Quad Cities Area Film Office. I hope you'll join us. There's a lot to celebrate in our town, and I'm glad you do it right here on WVIK with The Conversation. We'll see you next week.
You've been listening to The Conversation on WVIK. If you missed part of it or just want to hear it again, tune in at 8 o'clock on Monday evening, right here on WVIK. Support for WVIK, Quad Cities NPR, comes from the Regional Development Authority, distributing funds from the Rhythm City Casino Resort to help make the Quad Cities a more vibrant and inclusive community. Learn more at rdauthority.org.
I'm Marla Anditch from Rock Island, and I get my news from WVIK.
Broadcasting from the campus of Augustana College at 90.3 FM and HD, WVIK Rock Island, and 95.9 FM K240DZ Dubuque. Online at WVIK.org or with the WVIK app. WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR.